Welcome back to Engineering is Fun, You Should Try It, by Patrick Lettenmeyer, edited by Holly Jones, and narrated by Jack Talbot. Your donations make a big difference to Gonzaga students like me. From scholarships to classroom resources and strategic initiatives, your gifts make it possible for the next generation of Zags to thrive. Your impact begins at gonzaga.edu/give. February 1st, 1946, I was home, but my only clothes were two sets of Class A's, plus the blouse and my field jacket. First thing on my list was to call Gonzaga and find out when the next semester was going to start. I couldn't get info there, so I was off to find a job. I put on my only clothes, olive drab with a field jacket and no hat, and headed to the Washington State Unemployment Office. The line of guys all out of uniform but wearing mixed military garb went clear out the door. I scanned the line, and just ahead of me was my Gonzaga pal, Billy Wessel. After our interviews, we headed together to a speakeasy on Main Street for a beer. He'd been a flight engineer on a B-17 that went down just south of Paris. He made his way to Spain and back to his squadron in England, completing his 35 missions. He was now living at home. After the beer, when we headed out, some guy made a remark about the clothes Billy was wearing. And just like lightning, the guy was on the floor. What a civilian welcome. As I recall, the state of Washington gave each discharged serviceman $300 and 54/40, which meant $54 a month for up to 40 weeks of unemployment. I'd applied for the GI Bill, which paid tuition and books plus $50 a month for the number of months on active service. I started pounding the pavement, looking for a job matching my airplane mechanic skill set. I had no luck at Phelps Field, and tried my old boss at Spokane Air Depot, who claimed he'd have to lay off and replace one of his family man mechanics to hire me. Plus, the Air Depot was soon to be closed. My next best possibility was Auto Row on 2nd Avenue, so I made an application at every garage there, and a few more. Overall, it was a very tedious endeavor. I had written a long letter to Bernice describing my situation. She wrote that she liked her new job and her new roommate, but another summer in sweltering D.C. was potentially grim. I'd learned that the only air conditioning in D.C. was at the Museum of Art. All the near solutions to my problem rested on whether Gonzaga would have a winter semester starting soon. Mom came home for the weekend with a nice bakery apple pie and a pair of porterhouse steaks, and it was just like old times. My sister Marie was at WSC, enrolled in the School of Pharmacy, and having a hard time heating the rented house she was living in. Mom had sold everything on the farm except the rock house and the garage. She even sold the fencing, so the 15 acres accepting the residence was back to barren soil, just like my grandfather bought it in 1912. Mom called. "I heard on the radio that Gonzaga was going to open its winter semester late," she announced. "The end of February." I called GU and asked to see Dr. McGivern. He was glad to see me, and advised that I make an admittance application for the mechanical engineering program. Gonzaga still didn't have aeronautical engineering. "I'm in," I said both on the phone to Mom and in my letter to Bernice. It was going to be hard work keeping our romance going until the summer, and even harder work trying to study after 3.5 years of drought. I'd called the guy I'd sold my 32 V8 coupe to. "I'm sorry, he sold the car when he went into the Navy," his mom told me. "He's still on a ship." Next best bet was Auto Row on East Sprague Avenue, where a black 1936 Ford V8 coupe sat. I bought it for 350 clams and drove to GU in style the next day. Registration at the bookstore was fast. They had everything on my course list all packaged and ready to go, including a loose-leaf binder with a big bulldog on the cover, which I still have. I visited Mom for dinner with the juvenile inmates at the jail that night. They didn't look so tough, although one of the girl inmates, who was just 15, had cold-cocked Mom's woman assistant the week before. I thought the food was good. There were no inmate comments. The county had plans to improve the security by installing cell blocks with real bars, which I thought would be very frightening to a first-timer. I guess it wasn't based on the number of repeat offenders. I thought Mom should leave that job and go back to nursing, and I encouraged her to do so. After Mom had remodeled the large rock house into apartments, she kept the second floor two-bedroom apartment for herself. She let me live there. She was still the boss of the juvenile detention center, and if I timed things right, I could occasionally see her at lunchtime and find myself some good prison grub. I was a little apprehensive about going back to class the next day at 8 a.m., but I was determined to decline to be paddled by G-men, if they still existed. No beanies, for sure. I was among a lot of other ex-GIs at Gonzaga on my first day of class in February of 1946. Everyone was looking around to see who made it back. I spotted Ed Ralph and Danny Longpre. Ed and his good friend had survived submarines, and Danny had survived the Arctic on a destroyer. My good friend Billy Wessel decided to marry and re-enlist in the Air Corps. Danny was still one of Joey August's boxers. The XGIs changed Gonzaga for the better, or perhaps Gonzaga changed itself. There were no G-men, there were no freshmen hazing, no green beanies, and no football. They still had a boxing team and the relentless treasurer. Gonzaga was still all male, but it was a place of study. The instructors were more attentive and less distant from the students, and Dutch's, the blue and white, was still just across the street. I had told my mother about Bernice, and I could tell she thought that this case of propinquity was hopeless. So, like most mothers, she surreptitiously became a matchmaker, or so she thought. The target I discovered was my sister's best friend, a beautiful blonde, about 19, but plagued by a mama's complex. To get this thing put to bed, so to speak, I asked Blondie on a date to the Fox Theater with a milkshake on the way home. It was a long movie, and when I escorted her to the door at 12:30 a.m., there was her mother crossly escorting her 19-year-old daughter into the house. "She has to sing in church tomorrow morning," remarked her mother over her shoulder. I cannot remember ever seeing the girl again. My mother was tight with the girl's mother, and later asked me if I'd kept the girl out late. She was not in fine voice in church the next day, Mom said. Her mother excused it because the young lady didn't observe her bedtime. Thank you, Lord, for saving me. The winter semester was very difficult for me, despite my good study habit of hitting the books every evening until 11:30 p.m. and then going straight to bed. It helped that I lived alone without any distractions. My course selection at Gonzaga was all my own. There weren't any advisors that I knew of, so the courses were from a list of graduation requirements and few electives. My two electives were business law and economics. I got A's in those two, which helped salvage my grade point average. The requirement to have 18 hours of philosophy and pass a half-day oral exam before graduation always hung over we engineering students. 16. After the semester ended, I decided I wanted Bernice to come see Spokane. I found a job in the pea cannery in Dayton, Washington for 12-hour shifts 7 days a week, switching every 2 weeks at $1 an hour with no government taxes. I called Billy, who was a go to join me. We found a room in a private home with a nice landlady who was interested in our past. We worked for 6 weeks, leaving us 1 month before school started up again. "Would you come out to Spokane for 10 or so days of vacation?" I asked Bernice over the phone. "I could send you $400. "Yes," she said. "I'm on my way." The older neighbor girl was now the head of the Spokane YWCA, so Bernice had a roof and meals for those 10 days. We hadn't seen each other for a long time. "What beautiful trees," Bernice remarked as soon as we drove into Spokane. "What are they?" I almost said bull pine, but caught myself. "Ponderosa." She then wanted to know about the Indians. "Sometime we'll go to Montana," I said. We had a busy, nice 10 days. I introduced her to Billy and Danny, and of course, my mom and sister. We went swimming in Liberty Lake and Newman Lake, hiking in Dishman Hills, and picnicking on Mount Spokane. Everybody liked Bernice. She was the perfect, educated lady. Bernice liked everybody, and Spokane, too. I took her to her return flight. I didn't ask her to marry me because I had no income, and I didn't want to live off my wife. I sadly watched her fly back to D.C., thinking I'd botched it. When school started up again in the fall of 1946, I had 2 years to go for the elusive mechanical engineering degree. I found a part-time job inserting newspapers at the Spokesman Review. I simply had to insert one newspaper section into another section. It was piecework, where the more I'd insert, the more I'd make. I worked about 2 hours on each of 2 afternoons a week, then start the Sunday press run on Saturday about 6 p.m., and work until the press stopped about 2:30 a.m. There were about 10 of us, between two tables. It was a real sweat job, inserting, lifting, and moving bundles of 25 Sunday newspapers. Inserting required timely dexterity of the fingers. I always wore a thin undershirt and light pants because my clothing was routinely soaked after 7 to 8 hours of intense labor without rest, except when the press stopped. After about a month, I had my production count to within that of the top producers, one of whom was Bob Flagon, a fellow Gonzaga mechanical engineering student. He had improvised an inserting movement that only he could do, and he was always the top producer. I made about $35 a week. That semester included some tough subjects, like Structures 101 with Mr. Davis. He liked spot quizzes. After 2 lectures, we had quiz number 1. The next day, my graded paper was returned with a large red 9 on the front page. I'd never, ever had a grade that low, but I decided that considering the number of credit hours I was taking and my work schedule, I'd be better off dropping this course and picking it up next semester. Did you drop 101? Asked Flagon the next Saturday night at the review.
Yes. I got 9 on the quiz, I said.
The top student scored 17, Flagon said with a laugh. As soon as fall semester settled down, I called Bernice to ask her if she could come out to Spokane permanently.
Yes, she said.
Working for Eastern Airlines came in handy getting her a pass from D.C. to San Francisco. The bus from San Francisco brought her up to Spokane. Mom had a new job as an admittance nurse at St. Luke's and was living at home again. I told her that Bernice was moving to Spokane and that I needed a few days to find an apartment. She agreed I could sleep on the couch. Bernice arrived Saturday night. Mom picked her up at the bus station while I worked at the review. Sunday was a great day. Bernice was a bit tired but looked great, and Mom really liked her. Bernice was an accomplished apartment finder and found a furnished one in Spokane the next day. She quickly found a job, teaching at the Warden Washington School starting in January. Neither of us had heard of Warden. Among all the traveling and moving, I finally found a good time to ask Bernice the big question. We went dancing at the Spokane Armory on New Year's Eve, and on the way home, I stopped. I love you, I told Bernice. Will you marry me? I started to say something else, too, but Bernice interrupted.
Yes,
she exclaimed. Bernice's folks were still in India, but had plans to come to the States on their 7-year furlough in July. We decided to have the wedding the following August and asked her father and family to land on the West Coast so we could perform the wedding in Spokane. Bernice was determined to have a large ceremony in a white steepled church just after Warden School closed for summer recess. Everything and half the world had to come together for this wedding. And it did. At the Millwood Presbyterian Church on August 16, 1947. Mr. John Moiskins was the minister, and Mrs. Dora Moiskins handled all the wedding and reception stuff. Danny was the best man. Everyone remembered their lines. The ring wasn't dropped, and Bernice's brothers painted and tied tin cans to my Ford. Bernice was radiant and smiling. We drove off trailing cans with Just Married painted on the back window. We planned to spend the night in Wenatchee, then circumnavigate Washington State counterclockwise to home in our new studio basement apartment near the Garland Theater. The trip was faultless, including leaving a trail of rice in the lobby of the Wenatchee Hotel. Bernice was working for Northwest Airlines on the swing shift, and on the day we arrived home, had left for work that early evening. About 1 the following morning, Bernice woke me in tears. She'd been fired by Northwest Airlines. I had never seen her cry, and actually never again saw her cry. Perhaps my solace was sufficient, but again, maybe it wasn't. Nevertheless, Bernice never ever cried again in my presence. 17. In 1948, I officially became a Gonzaga upperclassman, with graduation on track for the next year if I conquered my classes and the dreaded philosophy oral examination. Mr. Davis's structure classes were sinking in, and I really enjoyed my business law and economics electives. My grades had picked up, even though my free time was nil. I did skip a class one day to fly fish Tacoma Creek. I caught 2 beautiful brookies, which helped the food bill and introduced Bernice to a Western tradition. Both my near friends, Danny Longprit and Billy Wessel, had dropped out, but Jimmy Hoy was hanging in there and did graduate with his degree in chemical engineering. In early spring, Bernice informed me that I was going to be a father near the end of the year. She was going to be losing her job with AT&T in a month, so we'd have to tighten our belts. No more Saturday evening movies at the Garland Theater or Sunday afternoon drives, even with gas at around 30 cents a gallon. When our semester ended in May, I took on some extra inserting during the week at the review. Our financial numbers still worked out so that we would be barely solvent the following year when I graduated. However, the economy had been drifting lower, and it started to solidify that Spokane couldn't handle my new engineering skills when I graduated, and we would have to leave town, which was a real disappointment. My fall semester philosophy class was taught by a priest who not only knew his Latin, but was familiar with the Roman and Greek intellectual community writings. Every week, I'd review with Bernice all of her Roman and Greek learning with my philosophy professor's weekly lecture. I liked the courses, but real time intruded when Bernice decided to give birth the early morning of my philosophy course final exam. Our first child was born on December 7, 1948. I had to approach the priest the following day and explain the situation. He arranged time a few days hence for me to take the final in solitude, which granted me a B in the class. My class on vibrations was taught by Dr. McGivern, who enlightened the class about the engineering solution to the excessive vibrations of the new Schick electric razor. Schick attached a tiny weight to the razor's motor support structure that was near half of the 60 Hz motor's natural frequency. That stopped the shaking in the razor user's hand, a concept that came in handy for me professionally some years later. The classroom was on the 3rd floor of the main building, with large windows facing the Spokane River and a large facility with a very tall smokestack near the riverbank. Dr. McGivern had a habit of assigning individual class members the opportunity to teach the class. When my chance came,
I had spent a sleepless night preparing the lecture and was reciting before the class of about 20 future engineers, none of whom were asleep. Suddenly, I thought I was fainting because my stance became less stiff. Everyone was looking at the smokestack near the river that was definitely swaying. We were receiving the residue of a large Seattle earthquake. What a lecture, I thought. I brought down the house, not the chimney. Every engineering upperclassman had an unrelenting graduation requirement of 18 hours of philosophy courses and a half-day oral examination with a group of priests. My opportunity arrived in early March, with my name and scheduled time posted outside Dr. McGivern's office about a week before the event. I had my wife assist me in the homework. After all, she had a major in both Latin and Greek, with a classical degree that gave her insights into the philosophies of the past. Every evening for a week, we reviewed St. Thomas Aquinas' writings. The day arrived, with my early morning encounter with the delegation of four from St. Michael's. During the examination, a three-hour miracle took place. The grades were posted on the second-floor hallway wall. I received a B. My graduation day arrived in May of 1949, 7.5 years after I'd started at Gonzaga as a 17-year-old freshman. At the cap and gown ceremony, Father Corkery, president of Gonzaga, handed me my sheepskin, which was rolled, written in Latin, and tied with a blue ribbon. The ceremony was outside, and, as the graduation speech began, so did the rain. It was a speedy speech. That very May Day, my sister Marie also graduated from WSC School of Pharmacy, summa cum laude. My mother attended the ceremony and was really pleased with both me and my sister. Then, reality descended upon my wife and me. We were broke, with a family, and needing a job, with none to be had in Spokane. The sad solution was to leave town, which we did, not to return to live in Spokane for 65 years. 18. At last, in June of 1949, after 7.5 years of wishing, I became a bona fide Junior B mechanical engineer working for the Boeing Company in Seattle at the grand salary of $270 a month, designing real airplane things. On the first day of my career, I drove to work at Boeing Plant 1, located in South Seattle near the Duwamish River, with no idea what I was expected to do on the job or what the attire for a junior engineer was. I guessed right, wearing a white shirt with a tie and sport coat. That turned out to be my work uniform for the next 33 years. I noticed some engineers had eye shades and others had arm garters, accessories that disappeared in the next few years. I was escorted to the second floor engineering department to a vast array of drafting tables interspersed here and there with a standard office desk. I had been assigned to the Boeing Experimental Air Tanker Project. The Air Force hired Boeing to design and build a single prototype military in-flight fuel transfer tanker airplane and to design and install the tanker system on a war-weary B-29 sitting on the tarmac at Boeing Field in Seattle. At the time, Boeing design engineers did their own drafting with pencils on vellum with four standard sizes, large for large parts and small for small parts. A five-size drawing was the largest at about 36 by 24 inches. All notation was standard, hand-lettered uppercase on the right side. The design drawings were standard at three views per sheet with a number and signature block in the lower right corner. My very first assignment was to design and make a drawing of the 2-inch diameter vent line fitting to be the termination of the rear fuselage of the B-29's main fuel tank vent line. It sounds simple, and was. Once I controlled my nerves and found the company-furnished 2H pencil, pink pearl eraser, and checked out a large T-square, and plastic 30-60 and 45 drafting tools. A few weeks later, I purchased a drafting machine and other drafting equipment that suited my skill better than the company-furnished equipment. At lunchtime, most engineers brown-bagged it, because the cafeteria was a long outside walk and there were several bridge games. 40 minutes after lunch, I was back to designing and drawing my fitting. Should the part be one piece, formed or designed with the flange welded to a standard piece of piping, I wondered. Just weld it, Jack told me. We are only going to make one. I spent hours looking through the Boeing design manuals and locating the acceptable welding procedure that could be used to fabricate the fitting. Every drawing required review by an engineer checker, with the procedure being to run a black and white copy for the checker and proceed to the next design while the checker marked in red the required corrections on the checking copy. It took me 3 days to perfect the design drawing and get it to Bill Elsie, the checker. The checked drawings came back with Elsie's red marks, more red than any of my Gonzaga drawing assignments ever had. The drawing was then released for fabrication with a signed form which described how many of the parts were to be made. My first design was on its way to be actually made into a part. This is going to be fun, I thought. At home that evening, I bored my wife describing the fuel vent system on the tanker B-29 we were designing. I was happy as a lark to be actually designing something for a real airplane. There was, however, a downside. Our work week was 52 hours long. That meant all our grocery shopping had to be squeezed in on Friday and Saturday early evening because my wife didn't drive. In the early fall, Boeing held an open house on a Saturday for employees and their families. Bernice and I hired a babysitter and went to the Boeing Field Tanker Engineering offices. As I walked with my wife to the tarmac and the B-29, I proudly described the fuel venting system and terminal fitting I had designed. It was right there. Right on the starboard fuselage side, halfway between the wing and tail section, in the middle outside of the fuselage. When I pointed it to Bernice, she burst out laughing. "You spent all summer making a hole in the side of a B-29?" she asked. Actually, she was right, and it became a standing joke with my family. "Wait now, you just wait," I'd replied, "and I'll tell you of some real inventions of mine, not just holes in B-29s. In truth, that tanker design became the KC-135, a 707 derivative that the Air Force still flies. At the end of the summer of 1949, I had been transferred to the XB-52 Landing Gear and Mechanism Design Group of about 20 design engineers at Boeing, forming a crew of experienced engineers and a few brand new junior engineers, like me. All of the junior engineers were Air Force veterans, but brand new engineers. We were located on the second floor of the new Boeing Engineering Building with a sweeping view of Boeing Field. At that moment, the XB-52 was but a glimmer in the minds of Boeing engineering. I was assigned to work on the flap drive system design with my boss, a senior engineer named Bob LaCalle. His sketches of the flap drive system showed a large gearbox with dual motors powering an epicyclic gear train turning a drive shaft to the right angle gearboxes at each flap, a concept that was fraught with hidden complexity. The right angle gearbox sketches were mine to design. Bob designed the main electric drive gearbox and was responsible for the entire flap drive system design. I felt I'd found my niche as a design engineer. I told Bernice we should plan to stay with Boeing and find a house to buy. We did. A one-bedroom, 625-square-foot home with a full basement, oil furnace, nice garden, and fruit trees within walking distance of both the church and grade school. The cost was $7,250, $1,000 down, $50 a month on a veteran's 4.25% interest 30-year loan. I thought the house could easily have an added bedroom and modified kitchen with a dishwasher. We moved in on a snowy day in January of 1950. Bernice relinquished her dream of living in Southern California and gladly gave up the kitchen and heater wood stoves forever. We spent over a year designing the airplane and watching the Boeing shop put it together. The following January, I was assigned to be the Boeing representative at Cleveland Pneumatic Company in Cleveland, Ohio, which was the manufacturer of the Boeing-designed XB-52 landing gear. I discovered that Cleveland in January freezes with Arctic north winds and intermittent snow, although the river doesn't freeze. Instead, it burns from pollutants. It was then I recalled the short lecture by Dr. McGivern. "Someday during your engineering career, you will become the representative of your company in a distinct city," he said. "You will be given an airplane ticket and a small per diem for expenses and will frugally secure a hotel room and look around for a place to eat, finding a beanery close to your working-class hotel. As you are walking to the beanery, you'll pass the dining room of a fancy hotel and recognize several of your company's purchasing department employees feasting and staying at the best hotel in town." I paid close attention to Dr. McGivern's lecture. The Carter Hotel in Cleveland was okay, and I found several more than adequate restaurants. I substantially overran my per diem, with the company paying the balance without comment. Later, Boeing gave us American Express cards, which I have to this day. Another engineer thankfully took over the Cleveland position, and I returned to the mechanic design group in Seattle after a month of hand-holding at Cleveland Pneumatic Tool. The airplane was still several months from completion, but we had begun working 40 hours a week on the design of the production B-52 that incorporated design improvements. On my walk from the parking lot to work, I frequently made my way to the engineering offices by cutting through the shop where the airplane was under construction. One morning, when I entered the shop, I noticed the starboard flap strangely hanging askew on the wing. A bit later, one of the liaison engineers found me and explained a catastrophe had occurred during the night shift. "It's always on the night shift," I thought. We found that the main flap drive gearbox location mechanism had failed to stop the flap extension and had driven the starboard flap almost completely off the airplane, causing a lot of crumbled aluminum. This design failure resulted in serious overtime and was my first lesson in engineering design failure responsibility. Unfortunately, it was not the last. Poor Bob, I thought. The complete failure of the mechanical position detection counting system was his design, resulting in a completely new design position sensing system, all during long overtime hours. We worked several weeks for more than 10 hours a day without a day off to complete the new design and install it on the YB-52 that was substituted for the first flight airplane. I was then assigned to work with Bill Hamilton on the design of the drag parachute system, a design that was tied in with the Luftwaffe.